This week on the show, we are at the 4A's, the American Association of Advertising Agencies, talking about who watches your ads, who doesn't. All this on This Week in Media, number 173.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 60,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/TWIP.
Hey there, boys and girls. We are back for another edition
of
This Week in
Media. We're all in the same place.
We're all in the same place. I can touch you, Alex. We're not on video today, for those of you who are listening later in the week, but we are doing a live show from the 4A's. And in case you don't know what that stands for, I learned today. No, actually, I knew what it was before. Now, the 4A's is like one of those groups that you hear all the time, and you just know it by 4A's. So you have to remind yourself what it stands for. It's the American Association of Advertising Agencies. Did you know that, Alex?
I did not.
And now you do. So Alex Lindsay is here. I'm your host, Daisy Whitney. And we have a wonderful lineup of guests who I'm looking at, who like, I can reach across and touch their arms, which is very exciting. Ted, you can just say
LaBarbara.
Yeah. See, I'm used to emailing people.
See, no one ever gets it right on the first try anyway. So
we're just going to call you Ted L.
That's fine.
Ted L is here, and he's the web editor for the 4A's, and he's also a TWIM listener.
I am.
And we are so grateful to have listeners on the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we also have
Art Sindlinger.
People are going to give me a hard time. Like, Daisy, could you make the effort maybe to learn how to pronounce your guests' last names? But anyway, Art is with Starcom. What is your official title?
I'm a digital activation director, so I oversee a few client pieces of business, helping them invest in the digital space.
So you basically decide where they're going to put their ad dollars.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to harass you a lot.
Perfect.
On the show today.
That's what I'm here for.
But before we get into the actual content, we have an ad.
We would
because
like to.
Because we like having an ad for the 4A's.
It would be odd to have run an entire show at an advertising conference without an ad.
Yeah, we'd like to thank
our sponsor, Audible.com. Of course, Audible.com is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They've got over 75,000 downloadable titles of all types of literature. So no matter what you want, you can probably find it on Audible. And of course, Audible offers a free book. If you haven't done this already, you can go up to Audible. You can go to audiblepodcast.com/TWIM. That's TWIM. And you can get a free book. And you can check it out. And Ted, you just did that, right?
Yes, as I said, as a loyal TWIM listener, I actually took advantage of the situation.
And it worked.
I went to audiblepodcast.com/TWIM. And I got my book. I signed up for an account. And I downloaded Game Change.
Fantastic.
I have not listened to it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. It's actually on my iPhone, ready to go.
So it worked. There
it
you
totally
have.
Totally
worked.
Very easy.
You can
we
get it for free.
And
Daisy, you've been listening to a new book, right?
Yeah, I highly recommend this one. It also happens to be with the same publishing house. That'll be doing
how
my
convenient.
Books. But Beautiful Creatures,
uh-huh,
which is a New York Times bestseller. It's a great book. It's by Cami Garcia and Margaret Stoll, and it's teen lit. As uh-huh. most people know, that's usually what I recommend because that's what I like to read. It's great. You know, I'm going to say that Twilight fans will like it, but it's an because it's got some similarities. It's a supernatural romance, but it's told from the guy's point of view and the girl has the powers. So it's pretty cool. So I highly recommend it. Know the authors. I just went to their book event in Santa Rosa at Copperfields on Friday evening, so I got to meet them officially in person. So there you go. It's a great book to check out. It's available on Audible.
Fantastic. And of course, you can go to you can get that book or any book that you'd like for free if you haven't done it already. audiblepodcast.com/TWIM.
All right. So we are here at the 4A's. So I'm going to start with you, Ted,
mm-hmm,
because you are one of the organizers of this conference. What have been the themes so far? Then we'll hit you up with specific questions. But what have been the themes so far? What are people talking about?
Well, the thing about the conference that was very important is that we used to have several national conferences every year that were divided among all the different disciplines that are in advertising agencies. And it just became apparent that between the economy and sort of the way that the business is changing, that really wasn't working anymore for us. So what we decided to do, and it was our CEO, Nancy Hill, that basically brainstormed this idea, is to have one major national conference that's sort of a mashup of all of our big ideas. and get everyone into the same room, everyone from marketing and media talking about the same things at the same time. And that's kind of how Transformation 2010 came about.
Well, the way that the whole industry is converging, aren't all those disciplines starting to converge as well?
Exactly. The lines are so grayed out now anyway that it kind of makes sense that this is the way to go, because you need to know all the different things about what's going on between, you know, social media or interactive or anything like that if you're going to be, you know, a force in the business.
Right.
And one of the rubs against advertising and agencies has always been, I mean, one of the themes that I've reported on in articles in the past few years has been the whole idea of silos. And digital has to come into, you know, the mothership and all of that. And that's been one of the challenges. Okay, is there enough money that's going to digital? I think that idea is starting to change, but that's what you're trying to reflect as well. Because it used to be like that. It used to be very siloed.
Exactly, and it still is to an extent. But like I said, that's one of the things that we're trying to be a force to change, is to get rid of all of the silos and get everybody talking about the same things at the same time.
People ought to be doing it quickly, too. I mean, the wheels are kind of coming off the traditional model.
So, it's adapt and change now, or, you know, get out of the way, basically.
Art. Silos.
Yeah.
So how do they manifest? Are you getting rid of the silos? Are you breaking down the walls at Starcom?
I feel like silos are less of an issue now than they were a few years ago. I've been with Starcom 10 years now, and I think certainly the early days, silos was a challenge. You're just talking about, you know, having it come out from different departments and who actually owns digital. That was an issue, sure, in 2003, 2004. I don't see it as much of an issue now. I think the bigger challenge is everyone coming with the digital idea, right? So having the digital idea coming up from the very beginning of the, I guess, brand ideation process. And it's less about not having the right people in the room. It's having the right people thinking about digital from the ground up. Does that make sense?
So who owns digital now? I mean, has it truly become at agencies across all disciplines?
I think everyone has to be able to think digitally, and there can be digital specialists, so it's more of a matrix type of approach. You're going to have people, everyone, your strategists, your planners, need to understand digital and how consumers use digital. But you're always going to also need a branch of specialists, because the space is moving so quickly and there's so many new partners coming up, new technologies every week. You're going to need digital specialists. So it's a combination. I don't know if anyone can actually own it. There's a role for specialists, and the strategists need to have some capabilities there as well.
What new technologies are getting you excited?
New technologies. I don't know if this is going to be exciting, or what's this going to say about me to say that this gets me excited, but media verification is top of mind. I know that's something that's out there, and I'm not sure if any of those partners are here.
So this is really knowing whether people actually saw your ad.
Yeah, and saw it in the places where we actually contracted for it to be. So that's
right.
an exploding space. I just saw a POV with almost a dozen partners side by side across a couple dozen criteria trying to compare who does what. So it's a very new space. It's a lot to sort through, but that's pretty exciting because, again, we go out and we contract space, and we contract space across a number of different reasons, you know, right audience, right context, right placement, everything about that we think is going to be able to connect with that audience. And we haven't really had verification beyond just the did it run or did it not run. Now we've got some more qualitative analysis of what actually ran.
And that actually ties in very well to one of the speakers that we had this morning, was from the Coalition for Innovative Media Measurement, where we were talking about things like, you know, you can now watch something across many different platforms and not necessarily at the time it runs. How do you get the truest sense of who's watching something, who's watching the ads that's also go along with it? So,
okay, Ted, I'm going to push back a little bit.
Okay.
The Coalition for Innovative Media Measurement. Do we really need this? Do we need all of these different coalitions and groups and task force? Because there's so many, and I feel like CIMM has a lot of big players. I mean, we're talking about Vivendi, NBC Universal, Comcast. I mean, pretty much all the big players are involved. But what is that going to do for the industry?
Well, I think just getting the thing that a coalition can do is it gets the big players to start thinking about things, because we can talk about it, I mean, all day, but that doesn't necessarily mean that maybe a CEO from a company is thinking about it. So, but if he hears this name of this, you know, big association or this big coalition that's out there changing the way we're doing metrics or things like that, maybe that has a little bit more of a resonance to him.
Well, and it does make a difference. I mean, we have to figure out some way to start, you know, verifying a lot of this stuff. I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, when we quote, for instance, our numbers, you know, for our different shows, you know, we quote the numbers that we get from, for instance, PodTrack, which are very conservative. You know, they are, you know, they're very verifiable. They're very, you know, they're solid numbers. And then, you know, it's hard because people in our space will quote, some raw numbers that are sometimes 2, 3, 4 times higher than that. And so people are like, why are yours so small? Well, ours are ones that you can count on. And we've decided to go that route. But it's hard when not everyone's getting along with how do we measure. Some people, well, raw is, it's a number that I can call out that is the biggest number I can find versus this is a number I can count on. This is the number of people actually downloaded our thing. And we still can't tell. We know how many downloaded it. We don't know how many actually listened. And that's going to be a different number.
What do you think most web shows and podcasts rely on, Alex? Do they rely, if they have ads, many of them are using Podtrac.
90% of them depend on the raw numbers. They want that number to be as big as they can make it. I think that only the ones that are actually getting advertising, who really deal with advertisers all the time, want the most solid number they can find. So, and we kind of followed Leo's lead more than anything else. I think that that's the, Leo really wanted to take a more conservative, Leo Laporte, everyone on our, the godfather of podcasting. And I thought that made sense. And to me, when we started doing them, I didn't really care what the number was because we created these shows without any advertising. We were just like, the way we are haphazard. We create shows because
really?
We would want to
watch
haphazard? Them. We create shows because we would want to watch them. And then we figure out, let's just keep on running them and see if someone will pay for them eventually. And most of them have gotten to that point where they do get paid for. But our model isn't quite what everybody else is doing. And so I think that everyone's using the numbers are all over the place. It can be their raw cash accounts. It can be their Libsyn account. It can be their, and all those numbers are different.
Now, I can't imagine you're placing a lot of your clients in podcasts or what have you. But when you are dealing with sort of smaller, if you will, forms of media, at what point is it too small for you to focus on? And what sort of measurement do you want to use in places like that? Forget TV. We're talking about sort of the nichier, more sliver type of areas right now.
Okay. And we do use podcasts. We have, as an agency, certainly use podcasts.
Tell us about what podcasts you've been involved in.
I can't speak to any particulars. But no, absolutely. Certainly it is a small piece of digital in general. But I think the challenge is the question, to get to your question about what's too small or when does it not pay out, it's what are you trying to do, right? There's a couple things. What are you trying to do? It can be small, but if it's the exact right audience that you're trying to reach for that particular program and you can do something custom like you're doing with your Audible integrations, I think podcasts, I'm a heavy podcast listener myself, and I think that's where I've seen some of the best brand integrations when it's done well. And I won't name names. I guess I'm not sure if we're allowed to go there, but it's a great job, right? So it's a small audience, but it's a perfectly targeted audience. That's fine. The other piece is networks obviously play a big, part of our game, networks and exchanges, where you can aggregate that all up. It would be impossible for us to go out and try to talk to you. Okay, there's 1,000 soccer sites out there that make a lot of sense, and it's a World Cup year, so we want to go and try to talk to every single one of them individually. You can't do that. But through Google Content Network or through an ad exchange, we can get into those pockets, into those niche targets.
I think that also, it extends to everywhere, because even working on websites and things like that, I still can't find necessarily metrics that I agree with or I think that I trust, because if you have something that you put a link up on Twitter, your URL shortener, like a tiny URL, will say, oh, someone clicked on that 50 times, but on the result website it says, oh, you only got 3 hits. So I'm like, well, how can there be this huge disparity? So it's just, what is really the thing to trust? It extends everywhere, basically.
So how do you make that decision, Ted? And how do you think advertisers and agencies make that decision about what to trust?
Well, I think that's one of the things that certainly several of our media committees are really wrestling with right now to try to figure out. And a lot of them seem to, I think what the best thing to do, I'm not necessarily sitting in on those committee meetings, so I don't want to speak for my committee, but if they all sort of agree to adopt the same standard and use the same platform, at least then you kind of have a baseline that relative to each other, you have an understanding of what's going on. And I think that's going to be what we have to do eventually. So,
how do you? Can I jump in? I'm just listening. What do you guys, when you're looking at stuff like the iPad? Apple's iPad's coming out. We talked about it probably a little too much. See, I can ask that question.
It's coming out. We can talk about it.
It's really affecting the a lot of people that we're talking to in the broadcast realm, both in broadcast or the people that I'm talking to in broadcast TV, in what used to be print. The way traditional print, which is now print/web/everything else, everybody is building huge initiatives for the iPad. Is this something that you guys are paying a lot of attention to?
Yeah, our team is definitely paying attention to it, and that's going to be another group within StarCom. We definitely, as I mentioned earlier, have specialists focusing on different areas. We also have print specialists who are publishing specialists now who follow that content across platforms, whether it's the actual printed magazine or going to the iPad. We're paying attention to it. You probably know better than I do what the actual sales projections might look like. I'm not sure what that is right now, but there's going to be waves, just like with phones, right?
The early rumors were 1 million that would sell, that'd be ready to ship at the end of March. Now there's rumors that there's some supply issues where there could be as little as 300,000 that go out at the end of March or whatever. So we're looking at somewhere between, right now the rumors are 300,000 to 1 million available in the first month they come out. But I think a lot of people are projecting, you know, 5 or 10 million in the first year.
5 or 10 million U.S. first year?
That's
a good size number.
It sounds like Apple is pushing a lot harder on these ones than they did, you know, trying to roll it out. And they have the advantage that, and I don't think Apple's making those numbers. I think those are analyst projections. Apple's probably saying 1 million in the next 3 years. I mean, you know they're pretty conservative about their numbers. But some of the analysts are saying it could be a fair bit higher. And one of the reasons is, of course, is that Apple already has 100,000 applications that are going to run on the iPad when it launches. So it's not launching into the way the iPhone did. It's not launching into a void. It's launching into something that's already built up, figured out, sorted out, and everyone knows they can make money at it, and they know that the people who made the most money, like the big hits, that there's still a handful of them. Last week we saw this game called Plants versus Zombies make $1 million in 10 days, you know, selling. So you have, you know, there's a handful of those hits, but a lot of the big hits happen at the beginning. When people are looking for new stuff, they'll click on a $3 application and pay for it just because it's the only one that's taking full advantage of the iPad. And so there's a lot of people who want to be first out. I know that these broadcast companies and these magazine and newspapers are all jockeying for position, to get out there. And it seems like that's going to make a big difference when it comes to display advertising. And it seems like with an application, the verification that you were talking about seems much more doable.
It could be, and this is where I probably need to get some of the more technical folks involved in that, but aren't there limitations with what Apple will let run on their platform, right? So I'm not sure if you're going to have the same scripts and so forth that it can do all the verification that we can just within regular HTML.
Well, you can definitely run HTML. You can run something that feels like an application on it. But I think that, you know, if anything's checking, like I know the way we have played with verification on our end is just that it bounces off our server on the way to going to get the ad. That's the simplest version, you know, of that. When someone goes in there, they get to that point, it's coming off of something, and you know, all of these apps are internet enabled, so they can be constantly accessing.
I thought, and again, this shows that I need to read up on my iPad, but I thought there was something about not running Flash.
It doesn't run Flash.
Okay.
And I guess that affects your... You know, it's not going to ever run Flash.
So that affects, you know, what we can actually do and what we can report back on. A lot of the things we're looking at is not just whether or not something ran, but positioning, time spent, engagement with an actual application, right? So how much time did someone spend within a unit or within an application? And if we can't get those
sets
of metrics
your infrastructure is built around Flash. I mean, the applications will most likely allow that to happen as well.
Is that a roadblock then? I mean, because we've talked a lot about sort of the future of Flash on the show and just in general, but I wonder if that makes the iPad more, does that make it seem more of a roadblock for advertisers to get involved?
Well, it's something to work around, because I think everything you said at the front, there's a lot of attractive pieces about it, right? There's a lot of things about it that are going to make it very compelling, that early adopter group. Some of the publishers are going to be out there with some very cool things, and you want to be associated with that kind of innovation, but it will have some limitations, right?
Now, you do social media. That's one of your big focuses at StarCom. Is that correct, Art?
It is.
Okay, so talk about that, because that's, you know, the hot area. I mean, whenever I do my iMedia conferences, you know, those are always the really well-attended sessions, and people want to understand, okay, how to participate in social media. I mean, it's just kind of open-ended, but what do you like about it? What do you not like about it when you're thinking about putting brands into social media?
That is a big open-ended question. I've been doing it since late 2006 officially at StarCom, and a few years before that, the accounts I was working on back when MySpace in 04 and 05, you know, we were kind of playing around with them. What do I like about it? What I do like about it is when it's done well. And that's when brands really, I know this is very cliched and I want to hit myself for even saying it, but add value to the equation. And you can only add value if you really understand what people's motivations are for using these different tools or platforms, and finding that intersection between why are they really using it and what do they like and what do they expect about your brand, and how can you add value into that situation instead of just trying to interrupt someone in that space. Go ahead.
Do you find that a lot of the, not talking to anyone specifically, but a lot of brands, do you find a lot of brands conscious of the kind of short-term gains versus long-term gains? Because it seems like social media is oftentimes a very long play, you know, because what it really comes down to most of the time is service. You know, using the social media platforms to serve people with generally, I mean, I know that what impresses me is when I complain about Comcast on Twitter and I get a support from Comcast, you know, Comcast Cares or whatever will respond to me sometimes in minutes, you know, and it's not just because I don't have that many followers. It's not like I have a huge following and I have a feeling that they do it to everyone. They're just tracking it. But that seems to be something that makes more of a difference to me than any kind of ad that people run.
And well, I think I've heard you on a past show talk about this, of what really does social, who owns social, where does it fit? Is it customer service? Is it marketing? Is it R&D? And I think the answer is it's everybody. Everybody needs to be in a coordinated fashion, right? So if someone's listening, how do you triage that and say, okay, that's a customer service issue. Make sure you take care of that or that. Wait a second. Somebody actually might have an idea that the brand team should think about. Maybe there's a new product development idea germinating there. So it's got to be everything, but you're right. And that's kind of an inherent conflict or inherent tension in reporting to Wall Street this quarter versus what's it going to build for us over time, 5, 6, 10 quarters from now, from actually investing in these platforms that help you cultivate connections and cultivate relationships with your right. customers.
Do you think brands are there yet in terms of figuring out where it belongs and where it lives in an organization? I mean, because we talked about this 2 weeks ago with Kevin Smith and Southwest. I mean, that's sort of one of the biggest examples is, well, who's responsible? Because I just think increasingly, I know there are ways to advertise with social media, but I think that it's more, to me, it seems like more of a branding function and more of a customer service function.
It varies, I think. And I think some brands are there, right? So your question was, are brands there? There definitely are some there that have been cited in the various reports, you know, Whole Foods or Adele or Starbucks or others, you know, that have been in the Altimeter report, right?
Do you like the work that they're doing with social media?
Yeah, I think some are doing a very good job because they have gotten, and I think that's one of the things that we talk about is, you know, why are you actually doing social media? And you can almost put people in two camps, and I resist this because I resist oversimplification of everything. I make things more complicated than they need to be, but are you there because it's your philosophy and you really believe that you want to have these connections with people? Or are you there because it's in fashion, right? So are you like a social fashionista? And you can see the differences when someone's trying to do something because they're, you know, it's in fashion, it will backfire, right? Or right. You won't have the same kind of success as someone who's really there for the right reason.
Well, a
level the right
of genuineness,
tools.
I think, in all levels of advertising and marketing seems to be more and more important because, you know, there's not as much control over that facade that we used to have. We just don't have as much control over anymore.
And I think there's also a distinction, and this is, there's so many layers of the social onion. You can do some things there, even if you're not going to be Dell with your team of bloggers or Starbucks with your team of folks. You can still do some things that are potentially one-offish but successful, right? If it's got the right idea and it's clever and it's entertaining and something people want to actually share or be compelled mm-hmm. with. I know one example that I cite a few times, even though I'm not a Shark Week person, right? Do you remember the Discovery mm-hmm. Channel, you know, Shark Week issue? It was a great example of that. It's something that, you know, they've got their enthusiasts who, you know, watch Shark Week every year. We've got them in the agency. And, you know, without question, I know I'm going to see that coming through my news feed of this person just did, you
what
know,
did they
the Shark
do? What
Week
was thing. The, what was the
it
social
was a,
media component?
It was a
component.
Facebook Connect execution where you kind of went in there and you connected with it and it gave you this sort of first-person POV as if you were swimming at the beach. I forget the actual URL, so maybe you can throw it in your show notes or your link or something so people can go find it because it's still up, I believe. But you get this first-person POV of I'm in the water and all of a sudden I get pulled down by a shark and you start seeing, like, blood in the water, and then it pulls from your Facebook photos and showing kind of like your life flashing before your eyes, and then putting up, you know, Art Sindlinger, 40, from Chicago, died today, and it goes that whole thing. And, like, you know, there have been a number of those
that's
Facebook
fun. Connected. Wow, that's so uplifting.
That's really cool, actually, yeah.
that's the kind of thing so. I like, yeah. I like, you know, stories about shark attacks and data. But it was one of those things where you build upon the people that have an affinity for that program because it is a cultish-like program, right? People who like it a lot. They're going to engage with that. And then that reaches new people like myself who obviously were, you know, mildly interested in Shark Week, but boom, that put it on my radar. I knew it was happening.
Now, a question for you. I know you're dealing with bigger brands, obviously. You're at a big media agency. But when you, for folks who are running small businesses, whether you're a realtor or you run a local cupcake shop or whatever it is, you know, I walk through the local mall and Corte Madera Mall is on Twitter. If you were stepping away from the advice you give to the big brands that you represent, what advice would you give to smaller brands, to the mom and pop businesses, if you will, about what their social media presence should be? I know some of the questions that they might ask if they sat down with you would be rudimentary, like, do I need a Facebook fan page? But what are some of the basic things, or even beyond basic things, that a small brand can do? Because we have plenty of small brands who listen to us and independent producers.
Well, I see that every day, and I don't want to be painted with a big agency brush, although, you know, guilty. But in my building, for example, in our building in Chicago, there are small businesses that I know are on Facebook and on Twitter, and they're using these tools. They've got good customers, just like, you know, big brands have their core brand users. You know, little food shop in our building or a little, you know, haircut place in our building got the same thing. They've got their loyalist, and they're using it for the same ways. They're extending promotions. They're largely you see a lot of promotions in that work, but also doing some showcasing, some photos of people, kind of building that community. If you have that vibe of community, if you have those people, your customers, I don't see it as any different than the cork board at the coffee shop, right? It's just the same kind of things you've been trying to do with your customers.
And I know my brother owns, he's got a small business. It's a golf course, actually, in Pennsylvania. And he doesn't use Twitter. He doesn't quite get it. I mean, every time I go back, I go, so this is Twitter, you know, but he does a lot of email, and he's got this huge following of his golfers. So all the regular golfers are on this email list, and he sends out funny stories, and they're off the wall and really funny, but they tell you like a code of something you have to come in and say to get a free beer or to get a free round of golf or a discounted round of golf. And he tells you, oh, by the way, we're having a sale. Like he'll send it out on Wednesday that tomorrow or this afternoon, it's less money because they've got a little more inventory, and he's got all these guys reacting to this email, you know. But to me, that's the kind of he's not really using social media, but he's, you know, but he in the way that we think of it, but he's still using those emails as a driver.
It's using it as a channel to connect with his customers, right?
Sorry,
it's using it as a channel to connect with his customers.
Yeah,
absolutely. I can see some interesting twit pick from the golf course.
Well, I think that those are definitely great examples because, you know, the two things I think that especially smaller brands can do, it personifies you to your customer base. You know, sometimes having a little bit of a human aspect to your communications, it sort of makes you more inclined to maybe want to engage with them and be like, oh yeah, you know, that's a cool guy, I want to, you know, support him. But even beyond that, the thing that I personally have always, you know, as an avid Twitter user, is I see that there's no better way to get feedback on what you're doing from a customer base, both in terms of quantity and quality of comments. I mean, if you have something out there, people are going to have their opinions about it, and you could just sit there and read it, and you know what kind of business you're running and how your brand is doing based on kind of that Twitter feedback, because that's the most opinionated and engaged user base there is.
Well, no, that's a good point. I think that you can learn a lot about your brand, but it is the most opinionated user base. It is people who are active, who are in the bubble. But that's not necessarily everybody who's going to be buying or listening to your products. Do we run the risk of overestimating what people say in social media about brands? I don't necessarily mean Southwest and Kevin Smith, because that's bigger. That's a bigger issue there. But just for other brands, what do you think?
I think it's certainly possible. But, I mean, personally, I think that if someone who has 100,000 followers on Twitter has an opinion, especially a negative one, about something that's a product of your company, and it goes out to that 100,000 people, and then those 100,000 people retweet it to their audience potentially, it's still, I mean, that multiplier effect could be huge. So you're still talking about really large numbers of people possibly.
What do you think, Al? I mean, is there a risk of overestimating the effect?
I think you definitely have to pay. I think you definitely, more than ever, as a brand, you have to pay attention to what's going on those things. You can't just let it, turn a blind eye to it and not react to it. Because I think Southwest, for instance, did a fairly good job of reacting to Kevin Smith being upset about, you know, getting on, you know, not being able to get on the plane. I think there's a wide mix of reactions. As someone who has sat beside someone who was probably bigger than their seat really allowed, you know, my feelings were mixed. You know about that, you know, because I know that it's a frustration. If I've leaned sideways for 10 hours and it makes, you know, my back hurt when I got done. And I was like, they really should have put them somewhere else, you know. And so.
If you said that on Twitter, you would be attacked. And you were smart not to say it, but you were, oh, you did? What did people say?
I did not say it on Twitter. I said it on the show. I even said it lightly on the show because it's hard. It's also hard to talk about the gray areas because I think Kevin Smith's great. And I think that there's some way that they should find ways. I mean, I think making bigger seats or making other things available. I think that there is ways that the airlines are going to have to react to it. And I think what he brought up is a problem that in our society, whether we like it or not, is going to become more of a problem. So this is a canary in the coal mine, for them, and it's a very public one. I don't think that they just happen to be on the brunt. They're the ones that were last holding the canary. I mean, he could have gotten onto a Continental flight or other flights, and he just happened. What happens with Southwest is they just don't happen to have first class, which is what he would have been flying if he had been on any other airline, and that's the issue that they have to handle specifically.
Does this hurt Southwest? I mean, I hate to go back to this story, I think it's an ongoing one. Go ahead.
Well, my thing is going to be, you hit it. What if it did happen on another airline? We were talking about this in the building the other day, about this being a case study, and I think it helps Southwest. They've got so much equity in the social space because they have been there, right? It wasn't oh my God, Kevin Smith just tweeted about us. What are we going to do in the social space?
What is Twitter?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. They didn't have that. You know, they already had all these channels. They had the equity. They had the goodwill. And they were unfortunate enough. It's a raw nerve issue in society right now. But what if it did happen on airline XYZ that didn't have that credibility or that equity?
I'd love to find out what would happen. What if the guy who runs their Twitter said, well, lose some weight, lard butt, or something like that? You know, I would respect them for that. I mean,
well,
Ryanair has done that in the UK, right, or in Europe. I know they've had some insensitive issues on Twitter.
You've got to be really careful. I mean, there was a case of reseller in South Africa who got a little snitty with people online. I think it was Twitter, but it was some kind of online thing. And it created a real firestorm real quick. That's the other thing you have to be very careful about is what you put out. I mean, I mentioned that a Pittsburgh Penguin happened to win the winning goal for Canada last. And I think Canadians took that as me saying that it was American, you know, or whatever. And I got I got 20 tweets or replies in about 15 minutes, of something that I thought was just, you know, like this kind of half. And so that's not like, I'm sure that someone who has a lot more listeners would have, or a lot more followers would have a much larger reaction, but it's something you have to be very careful of. And that was something fairly innocuous. It's not saying being out there.
Yeah. So what do you tell brands about what they should be saying? Cause I think about that a lot, Alex. Like, I mean, you're pretty outspoken, but you also have to decide when to water.
I delete a third of my tweets.
You delete a third?
A third. You should, yeah, you can only imagine what I'm saying.
Oh my gosh.
There's a lot of things that I'll Twitter something that came into my head, and then I go, yeah,
Do you delete it after you get a response?
No.
Or just
no,
when
no,
you
no,
realize?
No, I delete before it goes out.
Oh, okay.
No, 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 no. I delete a third of them before they go out. Like I something comes
while
into my head,
yep.
And I type it in there like, really? Really, are you going to really do that through the take 25 items through the 15, you know, item aisle? You know, can people in Safeway really count? That's what I Twittered that yesterday, and then I deleted it. I can say it on the show. I don't know why. I don't know why I feel like I can say it on the show as an example.
Because you know why you can say it on the show? Because you can actually discuss it, because you don't have to say it in 140 characters.
140 characters is the thing, you know, it's...
Well, you have a different dilemma, too, that your personal and your professional brand is kind of the same thing. You know, so I have an advantage that I manage both my own Twitter account and a Twitter account for the 4A's. So the 4A's account is very corporate, very professional. You know, if I ever say anything personal on it, maybe it's something about, you know, I had a really nice coffee or lunch or something like that. And then that allows me to go onto my personal account and rant about anything that could ever possibly be on my mind.
And I think there's an advantage, you know, for me, I am managing a public brand and my own personal whatever, is I think people enjoy the fact that I talk about stuff that's somewhat personal as well. You know, I was talking about side chew when I was 12, driving a beat up truck. And yesterday, and to me, I almost deleted that one, you know, and it was a little too redneck. But at the same time, I was like, you know, people ought to know I grew up on a farm, and you know they're going to enjoy whether they can relate to that or not.
That's
part of the tapestry of who I am, you know. And then people enjoy having that knowledge.
Well, and then social media is not going to change your brand DNA, right? Whether it's you or the 4A's or Southwest or whomever, it's what's your brand DNA. Social channels can amplify, can help you express that, but it's not going to change it. So you're saying, what do you tell brands about it? If you're a very conservative, hesitant, reluctant brand in the first place, and you're going to get very uncomfortable the moment someone says anything that's potentially controversial, then a lot of these spaces might not be for you, right? Or you're going to have to engage in them very differently than something like Southwest has had fun in their DNA since, you know, day one.
Yeah, baby steps for some people, definitely.
And you have more to lose. I mean, and then you have fiduciary duties, and you have directors, and you have legal issues, and there's all kinds of other stuff that starts to, as you have more followers and as you're a bigger company, there are other things to risk. I mean, there's a lot of things that we used to do willy-nilly that, you know, we get very, touchy about now.
Do you think every brand, every advertiser has or should have a social media strategy? I mean, should it be part of their media plan?
I think they should be social media aware, right, and understand if a social media maybe philosophy or position. I don't know if I'm being semantical here with you, but I think so. Not all are going to necessarily be actively engaging. I remember we talked a little bit about the listening, I think, and the what value there is in learning from what people are saying in the social space. And I do, if I could hop back, I think there are issues of representativity, which I think is what you were getting to, right? It's a vocal audience and it's an engaged audience, but not necessarily representative of the entire audience. So you need to have that understanding as you go in. But I think every brand should be understanding or maybe paying attention to what's being said in the space, then figure out what is the right way for us to engage. It's not going to be the same, right? It's not social by numbers.
Let's talk about ad skipping for a minute. I went to the Beat TV online video roundtable last week here in San Francisco, and Kara Swisher was our moderator, and she's a tough one. You know, I mean, that's, she's built her brand on that, on asking very tough questions. And, you know, we had speakers from all of the major networks, from NBC, ABC, Fox. We had folks from vendors like Blue Kai and Yumi and Uyala. We have Break Media, Keith Richmond, and so on. But she asked a lot of tough questions, like, well, is anybody actually watching these ads? And it's sort of like the age-old question in advertising, but at the same time, I mean, it's so much easier. I mean, Alex, you talk about ad skipping technology that you use. About walking away from it. I mean, to what degree is this being discussed or being thought about?
I think it's incumbent more than ever that advertisers think of their advertisements as entertainment. You know, and because I know that I'll be scanning through, because we don't really watch anything live, I mean, ever. And so I'm scanning through ads, and when my wife will stop me to watch the Old Spice ad. You know,
yes. of course. I stopped to watch that one, too.
She thinks it's so funny. You know, and that's what she tells me, anyway. She tells me that
it makes me laugh, too.
Yeah, exactly. She keeps on telling me it's funny. So she stopped at that one. I'll stop at which iPhone apps are being, I'll look at the ones that are showing up on the Apple ads, you know, and I'll watch all the Apple ads. And so the thing is that I'm scanning and stopping to watch the content for certain ads. And I think that is something that is important for, I love those E-Trade ads with little kids. My wife totally gets freaked out about them. She doesn't like them at all. So it depends on who we're doing. But I think that it's important, though, to think about that entertainment value. The entertainment value that we got, that we typically, not this year, in my opinion, but typically would get in the Super Bowl. But thinking of some interesting storylines. I don't know if you agree or disagree or...
I'm just nodding my head because I've got the same behavior. I think everybody's probably got the same thing in their house of what do you stop? And I was trying to think of what I stop for. And I know there are some that actually go backwards because I want to watch it. I want to watch it a couple of times and pay attention to it. And there's that challenge of, again, adding value, whether it's entertainment or information, or really understanding the mindset of why somebody watching a particular program to break through and get noticed. I think it'd be interesting to have more of the measurement guys or the analytics guys in on this type of conversation, because I think it's probably just natural erosion. All of the TV stuff is really built on, probably shouldn't do a general blanket like that, but it might be too tough to reel it back in now, but the models for how much weight, how many TRPs do you have, and how does that then correlate to what am I seeing, you know, product moving off the shelf and so forth. And ad skipping is just an erosion, right? It's a drag. It's a drag coefficient on that overall top line weight that you're putting through. And until it really gets to the point where, wow, we're really not seeing the connection between our above-the-line campaigns and product moving off the shelves, it's kind of like the frog in the boiling water a little bit.
Now, of course, if you talk to somebody like Bob Garfield with his chaos scenario, you know, the sky is falling and it's just going to smash down and nothing's going to be left. What do you think, Ted?
Well, no. I mean, I think it's definitely different than, you know, if 20 years ago you had a campaign, you just pick a couple of channels and run it constantly. But now, obviously, that's not going to work anymore because people can skip their ads or they're not watching it at all. So, if anything, I think it frees up people creatively to come up with all sorts of different ways of having campaigns and doing things. You know, I think that integrated marketing is kind of like the future of the business. And so if you want to really start to reach your consumer base, it can't just be that kind of specific media buy at this one channel at this one time, things like that. You know, you might have to do other things and be creative about ways of reaching people. And, you know, that's not, people aren't afraid to interact with ads in other places. I mean, I think that if you had, you know, a good campaign on a website or on a Facebook or something like that, I don't think that's going to turn off people either. So, you know, there are other ways to reach people. It's just you have to kind of figure out where that is.
And you get some people, I like talking about like the Pepsi, you know, this, their campaign where they're giving money to people who want to make a difference at all different levels. So the, and
Refresh everything.
Project. Where they just, you know, I think that's a great, you get a lot of people talking about it. You get a lot of people thinking about it. I'm thinking about it. I do a lot of stuff.
You drinking Pepsi more?
No. The funny thing is that I'm talking about Pepsi on a show, and I'm excited about what they're doing. And I still drink Coke. But that's a whole different problem that a lot of these guys have. But I think attaching to people who are also really interested in your product, though, is important. You know, for instance, it's easy for us. Well, we're really touchy. We are PodTrack's kind of worst nightmare when it comes to a set of shows because we're really picky. Like, no, we don't. I don't really like them. I don't really use them. I don't really like. We're very protective of our brand as Twim or MacBreak or whatever. If I don't like or don't use or not interested in the product that is being offered to us, you know, we'll turn it down. Like,
Even tried to do it, all the listeners would know.
They'd all know.
Especially if we just read it straight out. That's the authenticity and the transparency.
I listen to books all the time. You know, it's easy for me to talk about Audible.
You see that with mainstream media as well, though. And there's a difference between the brands or the companies that they'll sell advertising to and just run your spot in a pod and the ones that make sense to do a vignette, right? I mean, think about, I don't know how much you're watching The Shelter, the Food Networks, or even some of the entertainment networks, or Sundance. You see vignettes more and more often, right, to kind of make that connection, sort of weave the advertiser message into the thread of what the program's about. So you find yourself actually stopping when you're about to fast forward through a pod because, wait a second, that's a vignette, and that's actually
a
hybrid.
And one of the things is, and for a long time I've talked about the fact that I think that narrative content really has a problem, more of a problem, because it's much more expensive to produce than non-narrative. And it's also, it doesn't have that same connection. And when I'm watching Lost, I don't really care what shirt they wear. I mean, some people do, you know, but I'm not typically worried about what shoes or shirts or whatever they're wearing. I'm into the show. When Alton Brown talks about knives, I'm taking notes. Like, you know, I have a lot, my kitchen, I'm in a weird situation where my wife has a kitchen and I have a kitchen.
He's got a great situation.
60-70% of my kitchen is stuff that I got attached to over slow impacts from Alton Brown. That's what I watch when I figure out how I want to cook. And so, but the thing is, that kind of, you know, and I know that some of them have advertised later because he keeps on talking about them. The hard part is that as soon as the listeners feel like people are paying to get on the show, it undermines the entire system. So it has to be something that's driven from the host's personal whims, you know, and interest, and then advertising comes after that.
My husband said that about Anthony Bourdain's show, No Reservations. He watches it on iTunes every week. So, and he'll show me certain parts of the show. He's like, all right, I got to show this to you. It was the first time he brought out the Sapphire card. Because, you know, he's traveling to the most exotic locations in the world, eating this completely, you know, native food. And so on one episode, he goes, let me get that. And he puts the Sapphire card down, and he just, Jeff had to show it to me. He's like, okay, Anthony has never once said, let me get that. I never once put the card down. I go, I know, but now you got to pay the bills. And it didn't turn him off. He loves the show, and he'll keep watching. But it's an interesting case where it fit, but did it fit? I don't know. I mean, I have, you know, it's just interesting. It gets you thinking about, like, what exactly are those lines? I mean, I know every single time I see a Diet Coke in a TV show, you may think product placement. You don't think, oh, the character's drinking a Diet Coke.
It's a great idea, but there still has to be the execution, right? We've all seen those clumsy executions, and that's the big challenge. And that's, I guess, where you're always going to need someone in the marketing space to shape that, to match that fit. If it was as easy as just dropping in the Sapphire card and saying, aha, here we go, and let me get that, then you know, anybody can do it. But there's obviously nuance that needs to respect the relationship with the, you know, the viewer, with the brand, with everything. It's tricky, not easy.
Question for you, and then we're going to start to wrap this up. I get a lot of emails from folks who have their own web shows. Probably happens to you as well, Alex, but somebody's launching something. I mean, we just had the Streamy Awards. Actually, the nominees were announced today. So there's a lot going on with that. I'll get a lot of emails and folks saying, you know, I'd love for you to look at my show. Do you have any thoughts on who might be a good advertiser? Do you have any tips for me on how to reach out to advertisers? You know, obviously they're playing in a smaller field in terms of views initially, but you know, what advice would you, and then I'm going to turn to you, Ted, as well, but what advice would you, artist, somebody who's with an agency, give to an independent producer starting their own web show, starting their own podcast, who are going to ask Alex and me questions, how do I get advertisers?
Wow, that's a hard one. I guess one model, who do you think who's in your competitive set? If you're starting off a show that's about X, who else is doing that stuff very well, and who's advertising with them right now as a starting point? Realistically, then yeah, I guess you have a couple of different paths. One, do you think you can go with, you know, sponsorship? And I want to work very closely with a small subset of brands, your Alton Brown and Knife example. You know, I've got a very small consideration set. I'm going to go after five, and we're going to offer them premium integration opportunities. Or do you want to go more of a network buy? And I think it's probably a function of how much scale do you ultimately expect. If I don't know what that threshold is, but you know, under X number of views, you're probably going to have a limited opportunity going the network route, right? You can fill space, you can get ads sold, but it's not necessarily going to really enrich your brand. Do you want to go more of this branding path of, my show is all about this, and here's our point of view, and we're exactly right for these advertisers? Go for it. Reach out to the agency. Reach out to the brand manager. And we get those all the time. They come through, and I can't say that they all stick, but sometimes we'll get it through. Their brand manager will pass it over and say, hey, what about this property? It seems right on. So take a crack.
I think even beyond that, I think the single most important thing, especially if you're starting out with a small product, is you have to make sure that you're entertaining yourself and that you are comfortable with what you're doing first. Because, I mean, I see all the time, especially on Twitter, things like that, where people, you can just tell that they're there to make a buck. They don't care what they're kind of regurgitating at you, things like that. And you know what? I couldn't care less what they have to say, and I don't pay attention to that. But if someone is really out there just enjoying themselves, talking about things that are to heart, I'm going to want to listen to what they have to say. And I think that's the way you kind of can organically really build an audience. It's not necessarily even about, you know, self-promotion, incessant self-promotion. I mean, I think if you have good content, and I think that you believe in your good content, sometimes your audience may magically even just appear because they feel like that sort of, it just really happens. I mean, I think this is not happening on my own blog personally because no one reads that, but I've definitely seen in cases where, you know, good content creates a good audience.
Alex, what do you think? Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said, all of our shows start with, we're interested in it. You know, we're passionate about this area. You know, to us, media, Max, you know, that type of thing. That's what we're passionate about. So that's what we make stuff about. And we don't, I mean, there are people who hire us for, you know, they hire us to make podcasts for them. They're not our podcasts. I mean, and that's a big part of our business is other people hire us to do work for them when they want to get out there and provide, you know, access their audience, you know, using video and so on and so forth. And so, that's how we handle that end of things. I think that, you know, definitely when we think about, you know, we've had Podtrac doing a lot. They do the advertising for this. They've done a lot of the advertising for the other ones. I think that, but we also, when we've sold ads for our own shows, and we have done that on and off since we started, is a lot of times we'll go to a magazine in the field that we're interested in, and we just look at everyone who's advertising. Because chances are they're paying more in that magazine at Borders than they would be paying for an ad on our show. And the question is, would they get more value? You know, and so that's usually, you know, that's a whole bunch of people who know advertising is important to them because they advertise somewhere. And so that, you know, I'm looking at that. That's usually where I look at the space as far as like, you know, who might be. And then I'm looking at, on top of those advertisers, I'm looking at who do I like. You know, I'm not looking at who's available. But okay, there's 100 different people that advertised in Macworld magazine. which vendors do I actually use? Because we buy stuff from all of them. Or not all of them, but a big chunk of them. Which ones do we really like? Which ones will we be proud of? Which ones are going to build? Which ones are going to improve our brand just because they're advertising? They're a mark. You know, like when Ford wants to advertise Sync on our shows, I think that improves our brand, you know? And we've had a couple where they didn't. Not Ford. I mean, in the past, where we put it on, we thought we were getting one thing, and they started putting other ads on, and we were like, we really wish we hadn't done that. You know, and that's when we became super picky about it as well. That was years ago, but I mean, it really made us very touchy about what ends up on the show.
Alex, where can people find you?
I'm on the Twitters. Alex Lindsay, all one word.
Ted, where can people find you?
You can find me also on Twitter. My corporate account is 4As, 4AS, and my personal account is Geek Soapbox.
Geek Soapbox. Nice. All right. And Art, where can people find you?
Wow. LinkedIn's probably the best way to find me. Art Sindlinger, LinkedIn.
And that's SINDLINGER. And I am DaisyWhitney.com. We're over and out.